From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, state lawmakers are back in Lansing to start the fall session. We'll see what is on the agenda.
One person's reform is another person's awful legislation.
Plus, renewed appreciation for a liberal arts degree.
You can always get the accounting focus down the road.
The West Michigan author who has published 4 books, and she is 10.
I liked having that power over, like, my characters and their feelings and their emotions and their conflicts. I love being, like, the controller of that.
And the story of the man who rescued Michigan's trout.
And remember, he's 99 and a half years old, and he said, "What are you going to do to keep up the fight for trout, boy?"
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What happens when our laws conflict with someone's religious beliefs? That was a big talking point in the debate over gay marriage, and now it's being used to oppose some of our immigration laws.
ICE has the right to break into my building whenever they choose to. I have the right not to open the door.
Later in the hour, we'll hear from some faith-based leaders on the role their churches play in immigration. But first, Michigan school kids made their way back to their classrooms Tuesday for the start of a new school year. Today, our state lawmakers made their way back to the Capitol for this, the first day of the fall session. Let's see what's on the agenda as we welcome Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Service and Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. The number one issue in your view for the fall session. Zach, go.
I think you got to go with auto insurance. I don't know that anything will necessarily happen. But I think that's where most of the focus and attention is going to be from the legislative leadership, the mayor of Detroit, and the huge phalanx of interest groups. You know, this here we go again. This has been around for years and years and years. And, you know, the same dynamics that have stopped auto insurance legislation from moving forward in the past are still firmly in place.
And I'd have to go with Zach on auto no fault. And it's, you know, some kind of an auto no-fault overhaul, especially as it pertains to Michigan's unlimited medical benefits, has been the holy grail of Republican policymaking for as long as I've covered this place, and about as difficult to attain. The game changer possibly being, in this case, the full engagement of the mayor of Detroit, where, you know, Mike Duggan just needs to bring down auto insurance rates if he's going to get people to live in the city and, you know, acknowledge living in the city. There are people who live there who actually claim residences somewhere else just to get affordable insurance.
And we know he has promised you're going to see the city of Detroit working with, you know, far right-wing Republicans just to get this happening. But we saw today Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff saying any plan that would automatically reduce auto insurance premiums is DOA in the Senate.
Like I said, the same dynamics that have stymied this issue in the past are still firmly in place. You know, let's keep in mind this, though, and I take the Senator Meekhoff at his word, but, you know, he also, if you just to quickly go back to the teacher pension legislation, he put some pretty firm lines in the sand there, too. But, you know, if it actually gets to the point where there's a final deal to be cut, you know, I'd be surprised if everything remained off the table, if that wasn't the final piece to actually get something to the governor's desk.
Is there anything being floated that you're hearing, Buzz, that, you know, yeah, we could get behind X, Y, or Z? Are you hearing anything, Rick?
Nothing that I think at this juncture has the potential of achieving critical mass. I mean, something is going to have to change from the traditional way that this has played out. I think in that you're just going to keep hearing a lot of agreement between me and Zach that this is difficult. I remember, you know, you go back to the 1990s when during the shared power session and when Republicans had the gavel for the first time in decades, one of the very first things that they attempted was capping auto insurance medical benefits. You know, fast forward to today, you know, we're still having the same discussion that always seems to wind up in the same place. But like we said, that the mayor of Detroit is very engaged on it. It's a high priority of his. It's a priority of Governor Snyder's. And House Speaker Tom Leonard has been working on this since the last session. So they're not, you know, just you know, starting at square one.
You know, I spoke to Lana Tice. She's the state representative who chairs the insurance committee last week, and tried to get an answer from her on whether the legislation there in the process of assembling would require a rate cut by insurers. And she really danced around that issue. I think what she's saying, what she was implying is we're going to make changes that would enable a rate cut. Whereas Meekhoff is drawing a line in the sand, that was sort of left open in the House. Clearly, the energy right now is with the mayor of Detroit and the House.
And Republicans have always been reluctant to adopt something where they would mandate that insurance companies roll back rates somehow. First of all, it just doesn't, you know, fit with their market-driven ideology. But the other thing, too, is so, you know, you roll back rates in 2018 or 2019, but, you know, what's to stop insurance companies from at some point just, you know, jacking them back up to make up the difference?
Let's switch over to talk about something that you just touched on, Zach, and that's local government pension reform. And we know the Republicans pushed through changes to the Michigan Public School Employers Retirement System earlier in the year. And just give us a refresher what happened there, Rick.
This was this dealt with new teachers. It basically created strong incentives to move them from a traditional pension, a defined benefit system, into something more like a 401k. And Republicans in the legislature, Governor Snyder, say that, local governments are facing the same pension pressures, so we need to do something about those costs as well. And remember, even though they haven't always agreed on the path forward, that Governor Snyder and legislative Republicans have been very focused on what's known as legacy costs, the long-term costs of local government retirees, especially as they pertain to health care.
What do you want to add in there, Zach?
Well, I think this is, if there's one issue I think the governor is really keen to try to get done before his time in office ends at the end of next year, it seems to be local government retirement reform, quote-unquote reform. One person's reform is another person's awful legislation. You know, he talked about this extensively last year. There was a late push in the House to maybe try to do something, but it fell apart quickly. You know, this goes right into his sort of sweet spot of finances and, as Rick said, long-term financial thinking. So he's very keen on it, but we haven't seen what the legislation would look like yet. There's a large work group that's been working on this. The trick is you really can't do a one-size-fits-all situation here, because whereas all the teachers are in the same system, there are dozens, I think I'm safe to say, dozens of different local retirement options. I mean, there is one large system that many local governments use, but then many local governments have their own retirement systems as well. Some are in good shape, some are in really bad shape. So that's the trick, is trying to work through how to deal with that.
Yeah, it seems to be moving in the direction of identifying some best practices and then trying to get everybody there. There are some local governments whose systems are fully funded, and there are some local governments that aren't as well off. And this just brings so many things into play. Certainly, as local governments become more and more vocal about it, I'm sure we'll hear about the pattern of how much the state sends to local governments in revenue sharing.
I have to switch over to the fact lawmakers appear to be flexing their veto muscles. Zach, talk to us about this auto sales tax legislation that the governor vetoed. What was it, and how likely is it that lawmakers might hand the governor the first veto override since, 2002?
So when you purchase a new vehicle, if you, let's say I'm buying a $10,000 vehicle and I've got a trade-in that's valued at $5,000, right now I'm essentially paying sales tax on that full, not quite, but for the sake of radio, basically paying sales tax on that full $10,000 cost, even though I have a trade-in worth $5,000 to mitigate what I'm paying out of pocket. And the auto dealers and Republicans and Democrats, it was a bipartisan piece of legislation, believe that should not be part of the sales tax, the value of a trade-in. So that's the legislation. It's already scheduled.
Yeah, they've already done it. I think it was a 20-year phase-out.
That's right. They've already passed a 20-year phase-out of how that is taxed, the value of a trade-in. And this legislation would speed that up. The governor didn't really like the first bill that he signed a couple years ago anyways, but he's made clear he did not want to speed it up anymore, so he vetoed it.
He said that it was too big a hit on the budget, and beside, that they had already made a deal on how this was going to be phased out.
I don't think it's very likely that it will be overridden. I think if there was really the energy to do it, we would have seen some immediate steps by the Senate today, but they've referred it back to a committee, which is typically what you do after a bill is vetoed, where it'll be held. And it just seems to me that once they were all in a room for the first time today since the veto happened, the senators, that if there was the momentum for an override, we'd be hearing about it.
I think we would hear about it quickly, which we didn't. It was sent to the Government Operations Committee, which is chaired by the Senate Majority Leader, Arlen Meekhoff. And what that means is that he's basically taking direct control over the issue. And while there doesn't appear to be an imminent veto override threat, certainly that card remains to be played now for the balance of this session.
Guys, the new House GOP leadership came in at the start of the year with a lot of talk and great ambitions of reducing individual income taxes. Where are we with that effort?
It's done.
Dead in the water. There's no sign of life there, especially with all the pressures on the general fund that are coming down the pike. There just seems to be no momentum there whatsoever.
Even if they got it through the House, I don't think that it would clear the Senate.
Taking a look ahead as they all head back to Lansing for the new fall session, as we talk with Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Service and Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta, whom I'm beginning to call Pluchow. Great to have you both with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
You bet.
Coming up, the magic of being a writer.
I liked having that power over, like, my characters and their feelings and their emotions and their conflicts. I love being, like, the controller of that.
We will meet the West Michigan author who has published 4 books, and she's 10. Plus, we talk about the lasting legacy of Trout Unlimited.
They're still very deeply committed to that notion that we can take collective action to make the world a better place for trout and salmon.
That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's never too early to begin following your passion. And that's certainly true of 10-year-old Umu Kaba of Kentwood. She's one of Michigan's youngest published authors. Schuler Books of Grand Rapids has published 4 books by Umu, who is with us today, along with her father, Brima Kaba. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you're a 10-year-old girl. You are going into 6th grade. You have to be pretty busy, Umu. So when do you find the time to write? You've got 4 books you've published already. When do you find time to write?
Well, I usually start, like, really writing my books during the summertime because you have the 3 months, and that's when you get most done.
Now, where do ideas come from for stories?
Well, for my first book, Charlie the Talking Dog, I got my idea for it because I had always wanted a pet of some sort, and I could never get one because we live in an apartment, and pets in apartments don't really mix because they need room. So instead of, like, moping around and, like, thinking about it, I just decided maybe I should start writing a story about a girl that has a talking dog.
And as the cover of the book tells us, Charlie is a playful little puppy who thinks she will never be loved until she meets Emily. And that is Charlie the Talking Dog. So that was your first book. The Chicken Man, tell us about The Chicken Man.
Well, I wrote it mostly because I had a baby brother, and I really just wanted to write a story that I had read to him as a bedtime story. And the reason I chose chicken is because my dad just loves chicken.
It is. It says, The Chicken Man is about a man and his daughter who get into a little trouble with a mean village chief that always gets what he wants. But in this case, things go well. The New Girl, and this says, Skylar used to live in Paris, but then she moved to Michigan with her family, and she went to a new school with bullies, and one of them turned out to be her best friend.
Well, I got the idea for that book because I got a letter from Kentwood District that said I was qualified to be in a program called the Peaks Program. So before I did the test to see if I got in, I decided maybe I should start writing a book about a girl that moves to a different country to go to a different school and with bullies to see, like, what it would be like for her.
And this is something that, I have a daughter. I know that stuff can start really, really early. Is that something that you faced or you see friends facing in school?
Well, I've never actually really fought with that. I've never actually had a bully, but I've seen a lot of other people get bullied, and that just isn't nice to me, and I don't like that.
And so what's the lesson that you hope that readers will get from reading The New Girl?
I hope they just learn that being a bully just isn't nice, and if you are a bully, then just stop it and try to be nice, because you can still fix it. There's a chance for you.
And then your newest book, and this is pretty darn thick. It's A Battle for My Brother, about a girl named Elizabeth Sierra Way, Lizzie, and her adopted little brother. And Peter's always getting Lizzie in trouble, stealing her spotlight. Tell us, where did the idea come for this?
Well, because I have a little brother, and not the baby one, another one. He's in third grade. And so I always felt like he was getting all the attention from my parents, because before he was the youngest. And so I, instead of, like, getting mad at him, because I knew even if I got mad at him, you know, I'll still get in trouble. So I decided to write a story about it. And at first I actually wanted to make him, like, a villain in the story, or, like, a robot or an alien or something to make him, like, look bad in the story. But as the story went on, I realized that I don't want that to be the lesson. I want to be, like, to be friends with your siblings, because you're going to be with them your whole entire life. So instead of making him a villain, I just tried to make it like a lesson for Lizzie and Peter to finally get along. And at the end, they're just friends now.
There you go. Prima, when and how did you discover that your daughter was writing?
Well, at first, I didn't know she was writing because mostly I go to work early. One day I was ready to go to work. Then I saw a journal on the table. I picked it up. I opened it. I started reading some page from it. The story I keep seeing more of it. Then I stopped. I said, who wrote this? Then she told me she did it. Then I said, wow. I said, well, if you finish this one, I will help you get it published. So, and she tried to finish it. Then I went to Schuller. I asked them, I said, I have a little daughter. She's now 8 years old. She's been writing this for the past 2 years. So I would like to see if there's a way for me to publish it. They told me everything I'm supposed to do. Then I came back, I told her, I said, they are ready to publish your book, but you have to rewrite it back in the computer because it was handwritten. Mm. So then she took her time, she did all that. After, then I take it to Schuller, they edit it. That's how everything started.
Why did you feel, Brima, that it was worth all the time and the effort to make this, make your daughter's story something that's in a book that people could buy?
Well, when I was young, I didn't get the opportunity to go to school or to do anything similar to what my kids are doing. Mm-hmm. And I can say I am blessed to be here in America, because this is the only place you can find opportunity and all goodness is here in this country. So when I came here with my kids, I have goal for them to be successful, to get a better life than I and my wife. And then when I saw that, I said, this is worth it for me to take my time and spend my money on supporting her. That also can help the other kids, to motivate them to do the same thing. So to be honest, I'm proud of my kids. They're all doing very well. So I have no word to say how to describe how I feel about them.
Tell us a little about your family's story and where you came from and what brought you to Michigan.
Well, I was born in Sierra Leone, grew up there, and then left there. In 2000, I left Africa. I went to Malta. It's a small island in the Mediterranean. So I stayed there for like 2 years and a half. Then I brought my wife, then Uma, our older sister Rugi, and Alpha, the middle one, they all were born in Malta. So when Malta joined the European Union, so they promised us that they're going to give us citizenship. All the time we spent there at that time, they never gave us citizenship.
The promise never happened.
And when I heard that the American government now is resettling 200 immigrants to America every year, then I applied for it. After they accept my application, then that's how we came to Michigan. And since then, I'm here. I'm very happy, you know. So everything is going well for me, to be honest.
So West Michigan has been good to your family?
West Michigan has been good to my family, and I would advise anybody, if you want to raise family, to come to Michigan.
Uma, how does it feel to be a published author?
it makes me feel proud because, like, you don't really see a lot of people my age writing books or even doing anything like that. And it makes me feel proud that I am one of the youngest people to do this. And it makes me feel like I'm going to help other kids do what they want to do in the future. But I do know that I really love writing, and I feel like I'm going to continue it because when I write, I feel like I'm in control of the whole world. And I like that. I like having that power over, like, my characters and their feelings and their emotions and their conflicts. I love being, like, the controller of that, and I don't want to give that up.
Umu Kaba of Kentwood, her books are available, published by Schuler Books of Grand Rapids. We wish you much luck and keep writing, and it'll be fascinating for all of us to see where your writing takes you.
Thank you. I was happy to come here.
To her father, Brima, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
Casting a fishing line into the water is just about as Michigan as you can get. For some families, it's a legacy passed down through generations. It might be easy for us to take fishing in Michigan for granted, but did you know nearly 60 years ago, a group of fishing fanatics got together near the Ausable River to ensure that trout fishing in our state would remain strong for years and years to come? The name of the group pretty much says it all, Trout Unlimited. It's Wednesday, time to talk our state's history. Here with us is the Michigan History Center's Mark Harvey and the president and CEO of Trout Unlimited, Chris Wood. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Mark, I want to start at the very beginning. Just who were these anglers that met up in the 1950s, and to what purpose?
Just to step back a moment, northern Michigan had wonderful fishing that brought people from all over the country, even back into the 19th century. And into the early 20th century and close to the 1950s, the rivers were pretty much played out. They had endured extensive logging and log drives, and it's really scraped the bottoms of the rivers and didn't make them a great place for fish to reproduce naturally. So pretty much it was a put-and-take fishery, but they were still passionate sports people, sportsmen, using the river, particularly the Ausable River. And there was a gentleman, a Detroit industrialist and conservationist, George Mason, who spent a lot of time up there, and he met and befriended a successful salesman and passionate fisherman, George Griffith, and they got together in Grayling, and George Mason at one point said to Griffith, "You should start a conservation organization like Ducks Unlimited," which started in Canada in 1937 and was very successful. He said, "You should start an organization like that and call it Trout Unlimited." And George Griffith said, "Yeah, you're right. I'm going to do that." And he gathered 16 people together at his cabin on the banks of the Ausable River, including a really feisty rod maker and conservationist named Art Newman. And they got together on July 18th of 1959, and Trout Unlimited was born.
And what was the response like, Mark? I mean, this was kind of before the modern environmental awareness movement really took off.
I'm trying to pigeonhole them. They're like the plaid shirt environmentalists. They were environmentalists before they were environmentalists. And they were very focused on trout and trout habitat. So they were passionate and persistent. And some of these ideas had been floating around as far back as the 1930s. You know, there was an article published here and there about catch-and-release fishing, and Art Newman, who was a tool-and-die maker by trade, had started this rod repair shop and then built fly rods, and he, from his tiny little converted garage, typed out these passionate conservation letters to his customers and to anyone who would listen and get them to try to think differently about how to preserve the habitat so the fish could reproduce naturally.
Now, to get best practices in place, Trout Unlimited had to work with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Chris Wood, was this a good relationship or was it contentious in any way?
Well, in the beginning, it was quite contentious because part of what was going on, as Mark alluded to, was that the state was essentially masking the effects of habitat loss, of habitat degradation, of pollution, by creating and then pumping out ever more trout for fishermen to catch that were raised in hatcheries. These are fish that are reared in concrete tanks and then released into the wild. That's not something you need to do in a healthy river system. Initially, because these men, and they were men initially, were calling the question of this practice of using hatcheries to mask habitat degradation, there was a fair amount of contentiousness. And I will say that that relationship has evolved 180 degrees today, and TU counts as some of its closer partners, our friends in the Department of Natural Resources, in all of the states, but especially including in Michigan.
And to your point here, as the success of Trout Unlimited began to grow, anglers from other states began to notice as well?
That's right. I mean, it was like a brush fire. I had the pleasure of visiting maybe 18 months or so ago with Art Newman, who Mark mentioned earlier. Art just passed away last year. He was the last of the original founding members. And in preparation for that meeting with Art, I went back and read everything I could find. And eventually he became, after our first rocky 2 years, he became our executive director. And the job he defined for himself was to barnstorm around the country and basically, as he put it, evangelize for the creation of Trout Unlimited chapters in other states. And so on the heels of Trout Unlimited becoming incorporated in Michigan, soon thereafter, we had Trout Unlimited chapters propping up in states like Pennsylvania and New York and all up and down the eastern seaboard, and then it moved out west. And today, we proudly have 400 chapters that are spread all around the country, including as far away as Hawaii, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yes. Even though some of these chapters may not have tremendous fisheries like the Ausable in their backyard, they're still very deeply committed to that notion that we can take collective action to make the world a better place for trout and salmon.
Chris, if we had a chance to talk with Art and George and those founding anglers who sat down for the first time in the 1950s, what do you think they'd be most proud of?
Well, Art Newman, who is the last of the men who were on the banks of the Ausable River with George Griffith, when I went to see him before he passed away, we had a great visit and we talked about all any manner of things, mostly about Trout Unlimited, as you can imagine. And, you know, we did the obligatory sort of photo op with our second executive director and me. As I got up from that photograph, he leaned over and he punched me on the leg. And he said, and remember, he's 99 and a half years old, and he said, "What are you going to do to keep up the fight for trout, boy?"
Oh, that's great.
To his last days, that's what he was thinking about. For 99 and a half years, this fireball of energy named Art Newman pushed and pulled and cajoled and convinced and was completely evangelical in his zeal to promote the conservation of trout and salmon. He was truly a wonder and an inspiration to everyone from the state of Michigan. We talk a lot, and the founders initially used to talk about how they wanted to create a science-based organization. And today I'm proud to say that of the 230 or so professionals that we have working within Trout Unlimited, you know, that includes 20 PhDs and probably 40 master's level, either conservation biology or fisheries folks. And that allows us to really leverage science on a broad scale with both our state partners and our federal partners. And I think the thing that the founders would be most impressed by was that this movement that they started on the banks of the Ausable has spread and has such a profound influence in the management of all of the nation's cold water fisheries and the trout and salmon that depend upon them.
Mark, tell us about the exhibit the Michigan History Center has got coming up on the Ausable.
Yeah, so opening on September 30th, we have an exhibit titled The River That Changed the World, and it focuses on the Ausable River. And you cannot focus an exhibit on the Ausable River without focusing on the history and legacy of Trout Unlimited in Michigan. It was born here. It grew from here. We also are featuring Art Newman in that exhibit and his fly rod shop, the Wanagas Fly Rod Shop. So actual elements of his shop will be present there. Some of the literature he wrote from the very typewriter that was scrawled away in the back of his converted garage will be there. He donated all of his archival materials to the Archives of Michigan. So we have those materials, and we'll be displaying them along with the history of TU. We will have the boat from George Griffith, the Ausable River boat there that he and George Mason would go fishing in, and a lot of other history on the river, including some of the tourism dating back to the 19th century, the First Peoples' use of the river and the fisheries management efforts with the river as well. So lots of hands-on activities, fly tying, and even a virtual reality experience. We have a 360 float down the Ausable River, so visitors can jump in a canoe or kayak and put a headset on and float down the river right there in the exhibit.
Sounds great. Michigan History Center's Mark Harvey and the president and CEO of Trout Unlimited, Chris Wood. Thanks to both of you for sharing this very uniquely Michigan story of Trout Unlimited. It was great talking with you.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
Still to come, why liberal arts majors make great employees.
Organizations out there that are hiring, whether for-profit, non-profit, recognize the value that a liberal arts and sciences student brings into a workplace.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Religion and politics, always a combustible mix. During the long debate over gay marriage, many people of faith and their leaders argued that it violated their deeply held religious beliefs. And now more are speaking out against our nation's immigration laws and their enforcement by the Trump administration, and they're using religious convictions as the reason why. Today, some faith leaders gathered in Washtenaw County to make a passionate declaration of support for protecting immigrants from deportation. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia spoke with some of them to get their thoughts on the role of so-called sanctuary churches and what happens when their actions run contrary to our nation's laws.
I am Reverend Justo Gonzalez II. I am the Southwest Area Minister for the United Church of Christ. I think that the responsibility of those of us as people of faith is to educate our communities, to challenge our communities, and to encourage our communities to mobilize in the work of justice. Because quite frankly, if simply we come and worship on a Sunday morning, but don't live out that faith, then we've missed the essential message of the gospel, which is communal transformation. And it is the recognition that it's not about me as an individual or individual piety.
Reverend Deborah Dean Ware, I'm the pastor of Church of the Good Shepherd United Church of Christ here in Ann Arbor. Well, I think there's lots of different levels of our role. One is being a kind of what I consider a pastoral presence in the community, so speaking out on behalf of some of the most vulnerable members of our communities, that as a way of saying you're not alone, there are people of faith who hear your struggle, who want to advocate for change in our world, and that we want to support your families. So that's one important piece, because the Christian narrative has been hijacked by the radical right, and it's become weaponized, and it has been used to marginalize people as opposed to unifying people and uplifting people, and so trying to counteract that piece as well.
Rabbi Josh Winston, I'm the rabbi at Temple Beth Emeth in Ann Arbor. In my opinion, my role is to help energize my community to support Sanctuary, to understand that it's been a part of our history for thousands of years, and most recently, of course, grandparents and great-grandparents and children and parents who are alive today wouldn't be alive if they hadn't received Sanctuary from churches and other righteous Gentiles during the events of World War II, of the Holocaust, that people took in family members and made sure that they were safe. So we I think feel the need for Sanctuary very directly. And although this isn't the same situation for sure, we also understand that that people are in need right now and that we need to support them.
It's a risk that I'm willing to take. I have immense privilege as somebody who has been born and raised in the United States. I have white privilege as a white person. I have middle class socioeconomic privilege. And so until the rest of our community can be lifted up and operate as freely and as completely as I can operate in this world, then we have to do this kind of thing. And it's our biblical faith calls us to be prophetic, to speak truth to power, to be hospitable, to be a refuge for the most vulnerable and the neediest in our communities. It's really about our expression of our Christian faith.
I think the first thing is to educate yourself
I think, and I applaud people that want to open their hearts, because the gospel is rooted in love, and love moves and motivates. But we also need to understand that we are putting ourselves at legal peril, and that communities of faith are putting their building at legal peril. So they need to get educated. They need to understand what is defined legally versus what is on in paper as a memorandum of understanding. ICE has the right to break into my building whenever they choose to. I have the right not to open the door. And there's a distinction there in terms of knowing that legally they can do it, but ethically, morally, as a person of faith, I will not cooperate. And if that means standing in front of one of the people that I am protecting and being arrested to defend their right to be here, then I will do that. So congregations and community of faith need to understand legal implications, need to understand moral and ethical, need to have conversations about what they're getting into. They need to strategically align. They need to partner with other people of goodwill, other people of faith, other people that are community activists. We need to step outside of the church and build those coalitions for the greater good.
Those were the voices of Reverend Justo Gonzalez II, Reverend Deborah Dean Ware, and Rabbi Josh Winston. College and university campuses are kicking into high gear for the fall semester, students moving in, figuring out their way around campus, and if they haven't done so already, declaring a major. Now, parents tend to be pleased with a major that points that student along a well-marked career path: business, engineering, computers and IT, nursing. And if that student should choose a liberal arts major, you might hear parents asking, well, what the heck is my kid going to do with a philosophy degree or a history degree? My next guests are here to tell us that liberal arts degree can lead not only to a great career, but also personal fulfillment. Andrew Martin is the dean of the College of Literature, Science, and Arts at the University of Michigan. Dean Martin, pleasure to welcome you here
to
Stateside.
It's great to be here, Cynthia. Thank you.
And we welcome someone who took his liberal arts BA in political science from U of M, and he ran with it. Dave Bargers, the retired founder and CEO of JetBlue Airways, and these days he's with Counter Capital Transportation Opportunities Fund, and among many things, he's a member of Dean Martin's LSA Advisory Council. Dave, so good to have you here.
Cynthia, great to be here. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Dean Martin, we hear that term. We've all grown up with that term, liberal arts. The fact it's just we assume we know what it is. But what does it mean exactly? I mean, what are the liberal arts?
Well, the way we think about the liberal arts today in American higher education is a broad-based education where folks can really get an education about the full human experience. And that's by looking at the world through the lens of the humanities, the social sciences, and the natural sciences. And so liberal arts education takes that broad-based education, everyone has the same foundation, and then later on, a specialization. And that specialization could be something like political science or philosophy, mathematics, or chemistry. So it's really the best of both worlds, a broad education, but also depth in a particular area.
And when you think of the students coming in and embracing a liberal arts education, what's your goal for those students?
My goal for those students is to explore the richness that the University of Michigan has to offer, and to find something that they find intellectually interesting and something that fulfills their passion. Some students are going to be turned on by history. Others are going to find biology to be the most fascinating thing that they've ever seen. I aspire for our students to explore. And the broader that they explore, the more experiences that they have, ultimately is going to lead them to have better lives.
Dave, when you realize that there are parents who would much rather that their kid get into an accounting track or nursing school or engineering and not be an English or political science or sociology major, how do you feel about that?
Oh, my comment to the parents or a counselor or to the student: the ability to have this foundational education, as Dean Martin laid out, that and using that to propel your career, when you start to think about leadership, management, building companies, turnaround opportunities, I mean, the landscape is almost 360 degrees versus that track of medicine or that track of whatever it might be. So to me, it's that foundational opportunity now. You can always get the accounting focus down the road.
Well, now let's talk to someone here who's recognized as a business leader. Dave, what do you believe that student with the liberal arts degree brings to the table?
When you're looking for talent, the intellectual curiosity of an individual, the ability to be an effective communicator, the ability to be persuasive in an argument, to take a look at a changing landscape, whatever that might be. When you think about, in my business, it could be high oil, it could be slow GDP, it could be something along the international landscape. That liberal arts education is just foundational for that type of leader down the road. So that's what I'm looking for from a talent perspective, and that's what I would share with a parent, a counselor, and again, the student.
Now, I am a liberal arts graduate. I started in pre-med with a biology major, and then I wound up switching my major to history, thinking I'll teach history in college, but somehow there weren't a lot of jobs in the 70s doing that. And I fell into broadcast journalism 38 years ago, but there was some, I'll say, flailing around or experimenting before that happened. It is more challenging, is it not, when you don't walk away from college with a professional identity like the engineers and the accountants and the HR execs and such?
So it is undoubtedly the case that it is more difficult for a student who's coming out of a liberal arts education to make that connection into their first career. At the same time, if you think about the types of skills that our students are bringing to the table, making that connection is something that's eminently doable. You know, one of the things that we're doing at the University of Michigan and LSA is to build out the capacity to help our students make those connections. That involves learning how to talk about what it is that you're learning, to understand the language of employers, to be able to present yourself in an effective way.
To guys like Dave.
To guys like Dave. And to leverage this huge alumni network of people who are so dedicated and committed to our students through mentoring opportunities, through internships and the like, to be able to help, in a sense, our liberal arts students translate their educational experience to the broader world.
And I know, Dave, you have helped set up the Barger Leadership Institute for the LSA students, kind of what, to help them connect the dots and see what guys like you are looking for?
Very much so, because when I look back on my career, I always wanted access to the room, the boardroom, whatever it might be, that room that you couldn't quite get into, the studio. And when I think about leadership settings outside the classroom, and student-led but faculty-guided is really what the BLI is all about now, and it's celebrating a 10-year anniversary. And I love it because, again, it's the ability to really have access to much different settings. This past year, there was a group of approximately 12 students who spent the week out in Seattle, and they're touring the Boeing Aviation Factory, which is great, but they're also spending time with a tent city with homeless. And how do you manage that in downtown Seattle and all the population issues that are taking place on the West Coast? And this was incubated and put together through BLI and funded through BLI. And so these are settings that you just don't get when you're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. It tended to be later in life. It was grad school or somewhere else down the road. And so, listen, here's the opportunity while you're an undergrad at Michigan, incubated within LSNA. And Dean Martin, thank you, because it's going campus-wide from the standpoint of, again, the opportunity to have a little bit different leadership opportunity outside the classroom.
And Dean Martin, you've got a really creative idea of the opportunity hub that's going to be available that I know when you described this, I realized I wouldn't have been flailing around for so many years before landing on where I was meant to be. Tell us about the opportunity hub.
So the opportunity hub that we're building is a place and it's a team, and really it's an ethos for our college. You know, we embrace this discursive educational model of exploration. We want our students to study whatever it is that they're most passionate about. And I also view it as our obligation as an educational institution to help connect our students with whatever opportunities are going to come next. And that's what the Opportunity Hub is all about. We're doing lots of exciting things in the Opportunity Hub. We started with an internship program. Last summer, we had 1,400 internships in our network. And something that I'm incredibly proud of is that we met the full financial need for all of our undergraduate students who have needs such that they could take an internship. you know, through the generous support of many of our alumni, we awarded over $1.1 million in summer scholarships such that every LSA student could take an internship opportunity. The Hub is also connecting students with alumni. We have people like Dave with these rich life experiences mm-hmm. who have used their education in lots of different and interesting ways over their path in their professional career. And so we're involving our alumni in the life of the students, beginning at the beginning of freshman year, all the way through the 4 years and beyond. We're also spending a lot of time talking to employers to do two things. One, we're interested in hearing what would it take to hire a student who has a classics degree in your organization, but also for us to advocate for our students and help make the connections. And one of the things that we're seeing in the market, and we're seeing a lot in the press today, the liberal arts are coming back. Right? Organizations out there that are hiring, whether for-profit, nonprofit, recognize the value that a liberal arts and sciences student brings into a workplace. They bring multiple perspectives. They can solve problems in multiple different ways. They can put things in context that are beyond just the apparent. And when you bring that into any team, that's when you're going to get the best solutions. That's when you're going to be able to get the best outcomes.
And it's interesting, Dave Bargers, I hear Dean Martin say this. At the same time, we hear so much talk about technical and the STEM angle of things. But you're saying in businesses recognizing the value of that liberal arts student?
No doubt. If anything, what I hear with regard to STEM is we just need to continue to push people into those fields because there's also just a shortage when you look at the STEM fields. But the liberal arts education and the ability to really that well-rounded undergraduate education where all of a sudden you're talking about an individual who understands org design, org effectiveness, recruiting talent. When you start to take a look at building teams, team work, as well as succession planning. And I just love those type of traits when you think about what you can do in your career, for-profit, nonprofit, running a tech company, running a healthcare company, whatever it might be.
Running an airline.
Or running an airline. And I look at, I mean, the JetBlue experience from startup to Fortune 500, from zero crew members to now 20,000 crew members, and to be part of that founding team where you're now having to work as a team. And Cynthia, the early days of the debate, the art of the debate, and how you're communicating in Washington, D.C., or maybe across into international markets, the persuasive argument, where you failed as well, you want that feedback. I mean, this to me, again, when I look at somebody with a liberal arts education out of University of Michigan, here in Ann Arbor, or U of M at any campus, what a great opportunity. What a great piece of talent to bring into an organization.
So finally, for any student out there listening anywhere in the state of Michigan or parent of a student searching for the right major, what's your elevator pitch for a liberal arts degree?
The elevator pitch is this. Enjoy the ride. Explore as much as you can and know that everything is going to work out in the end.
Dave Barger, your elevator pitch is?
My pitch would be it's you can't see around the corner, but try to. And this is the type of foundational education which that intellectual curiosity, before too long, you're going to start to anticipate what is around the corner.
Dave Barger, retired CEO of JetBlue Airways and proud liberal arts grad of the University of Michigan, and Dean Andrew Martin, University of Michigan College of Literature, Science, and the Arts. Thank you so much to both of you for spending time with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.